From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with novelist Stanley Elkin about how his writing has changed since he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Elkin has been called an ingenious genius of language, laughter, and the irresistible American idiom. Also today, coming of age in San Francisco's Chinatown, we talk with Fei Mayan Ng about her new novel, Bone. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Delta blues man Mississippi John Hurt, and book critic John Leonard reviews Culture and Imperialism by Edward Said. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. President Clinton and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin met for 3.5 hours today, pledging that 1993 would be the year of peace in the Middle East. After the meeting, Rabin said that Israel may be willing to swap land in the Golan Heights for peace at the talks, which resume next month. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton and Prime Minister Rabin vowed not to let pass what they called an historic opportunity for peace. 1993 will be a year of enhanced relations between the United States and Israel, the president said. Mr. Clinton was optimistic about the potential for bilateral and regional agreements. The prime minister indicated that Israel is ready to take substantial risks for peace. Rabin repeated that Israel would consider a partial withdrawal from the Golan Heights, the land captured from Syria in 1967, in exchange for peace. But as he met with the president today, Jewish settlers in the Golan attempted to storm the Syrian border to protest any withdrawal. Only Israel has agreed to resume the peace talks next month. Syria is expected to participate, but there's been no official word from any of the other parties. The peace talks were suspended in December when Israel deported several hundred Palestinians from the occupied territories. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The weekend's major snowstorm that hit the East Coast killed more than 100 people and left many more stranded. The last 60 student hikers who were stuck in mountains on the Tennessee-North Carolina border were ferried to safety this afternoon. The students from Detroit had been undergoing survival training in the Great Smoky Mountains for a week when the storm hit. Near Nova Scotia, a Canadian helicopter has recovered one body from the frigid Atlantic waters, and hope is fading for 32 other men. They were on board a cargo vessel that sank suddenly in very heavy seas this morning. Meanwhile, life is slowly beginning to return to normal after what is being called the storm of the century. Residents of Florida are among those cleaning up today. This weekend's winter storm caused more than 24 deaths and tens of millions of dollars in damage there. Scott Horsley, a member station WUSF, reports.
Governor Lawton Childs toured storm-damaged sections of the state by helicopter today and says in some areas it resembles the destruction of Hurricane Andrew. The storm was more deadly than last summer's hurricane. Floods and tornadoes killed at least 26 people in Florida. Some of the worst damage was done by floodwaters which soaked homes in low-lying areas up and down the state's Gulf Coast.
The surge that we saw is different from anything I've ever seen before, the power of that.
21 Florida counties have already been declared federal disaster areas. Childs is asking the federal government to add 2 additional counties to that list. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Horsley in Brooksville, Florida.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved higher today, gaining almost 15 points to close at 3442.41. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-4 on active trading. This is NPR News from Washington. Police officers in India fought a gun battle today with 2 criminals they say may be linked to some of the bombs that exploded in Bombay last week. Officials say they'd been looking for the men based on eyewitness descriptions of suspects believed to have left suitcase bombs in 3 hotels. Some 300 people were killed and more than 1,000 others were injured when 13 bombs exploded across Bombay Friday. The explosions devastated India's largest stock market, as well as a large part of the financial district. In the first claim of responsibility, a Sikh separatist group called an Indian news agency today and said it set off the bombs. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has accused the conservative Congress of People's Deputies of threatening to undermine order in the country and return the reins of government to the communist elite. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
According to a statement signed by President Yeltsin's press spokesman, the Emergency Congress was an appeal to the local administrations in Moscow and the provinces to seize power. The statement also said that the president was deeply concerned about the threat hanging over democracy and reform and accused the conservative Congress of intending to seize control of the mass media. Since the close of the Emergency Congress, which stripped Yeltsin of much of his power, the president's been out of the public eye, meeting with advisors and preparing for an important visit from French President François Mitterrand tomorrow. But Yeltsin's struggle with the parliament is due to resume later this week when the conservatives are expected to call for the removal of reformist cabinet ministers, including the foreign minister. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
Premier Li Peng urged China's legislature today to push ahead with market reforms and high-speed economic growth, but he made it clear that the Communist Party has no plans to ease its authoritarian rule, and he denounced efforts to expand democracy in Hong Kong before it returns to Chinese rule in 1997. The Chinese leader is considered to be very cautious, but he appeared to be bullish on economic development in his speech that he made to the National People's Congress today. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of people who work in radio, like myself, were first introduced to writer Stanley Elkin through his novel The Dick Gibson Show, about a radio talk show host. Elkin has a dark comic take on American life. Literary critic Helen Vendler called Elkin an anthropologist of our postmodern tribal life. Robert Coover called Elkin a tragicomic genius. The source of some of the tragedy in his comedy might have to do with his health. Elkin has had multiple sclerosis since 1972. MS is a progressive disease, and Elkin now needs a wheelchair to get around. A couple of his fictional characters have had MS, like Ben Flesh, the franchise king in the novel The Franchiser. There are three novellas in Elkin's new book, Van Gogh's Room at Arles. The first is about a professor of political geography who has multiple sclerosis. Just as he's preparing for a party he's throwing for his graduate students, his wife walks out on him. I asked Elkin if this was him imagining the worst.
It's partially me imagining the worst, and it's actually something that really happened to me. My wife did not leave, but I was teaching at Boston University in the fall of 1976, and my MS was just beginning to kick in rather severely. And there was a snowstorm. I had been invited out to some student's house for dinner, and they were troubled by the snowfall, and so they asked if they could come and bring the dinner to my place. Now, this was somewhat awkward for me because I made it a habit never to keep anything in my refrigerator. I ate every meal out at this Greeky Spoon on Kenmore Square, and they insisted on coming, and I told them, but you must be very, very careful to clean up everything, because I never touched the house. I mean, I lived in one room, essentially, and wouldn't have recognized the kitchen if I had been pushed into it. At any rate, they did come, and they were, you know, seven sheets to the wind when they arrived, and 114 to the wind when they left. I mean, and it just became a disaster. And I did command them to stay and do as they promised, to clean up everything, and of course they didn't, and it was just totally out of control. My wife and family were not with me at that time. They were back in St. Louis, living the life. And when I wrote this novella, some many years later, I called on those circumstances.
I'm interested in how you think your writing has been changed, if at all, by the MS. Do you think it's changed stylistically at all?
No, I don't think it's changed stylistically. I think I'm able to concentrate more because the only thing I can do is sit in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I open the store in the morning, the bubble machine, the word processor, and sit down, and before I know it, day is done. Playing taps. So in the days when I could, you know, smoke and walk around and hop and skip and play ping pong, that was always a lot more fun than writing, and so I did it. Today, you know, I do my work.
I interviewed Andre Debuse
not too long ago, and he is paralyzed from the waist down.
I know that.
Yeah, because of a car accident that he was in. And he was telling me that he was having such a hard time writing, and he was trying to write about, you know, able-bodied people, and he was spending all this time.
That's because I know why that is. It's because his thing came on so abruptly.
Right. Well, what he told me was that he didn't want to write about somebody. He didn't want to write fiction about somebody who was in a wheelchair, because he felt that until he could write about somebody who could get up and walk around, and that he wasn't really writing yet. Did you ever go through a crisis like that?
No, not really. I mean, when the MS was diagnosed in England in 1972, I went into a kind of clinical depression almost, but I lay in my bed and read The Drapes, and finally Joan said, let's go to the movies. We went to the movies, and that was the end of it.
How long did the depression last?
Maybe 2 weeks.
How was it diagnosed?
Oh, I began with a kind of numbness in my fingers, which I thought at the time, you know, it was just from bad posture or something. Then they sent me to a gym, and the numbness in my right finger spread to a general numbness in my left hand. And then they put me in the hospital and gave me this spinal tap and said, it's MS, kiddo. And I didn't know what MS was, and it scared the hell out of me. And I thought, you know, I would be falling downstairs. But that didn't happen. And that's what I mean by what happened to Andre Dubuque. I mean, his came on, you know, so suddenly. Mine, you know, you can get accustomed to anything.
Uh-huh.
And so from 72 to 75, I had this tingling. I didn't start using a cane until 76. And then it's only been a few years since I've been in a wheelchair. And, you know, I can hardly remember the good old days.
Right. I want to ask you a little bit about growing up. Your father was a salesman for, I believe, costume jewelry?
Right, a firm called Coro.
So did he have to travel around and sell it? Was he a traveling salesman?
He was a traveling salesman, and he was away for perhaps 2 and 3 weeks at a time.
Uh-huh.
I guess then he would come home on weekends, and I saw him, you know, half my life.
And the other half he was gone?
Right.
Was he a good salesman?
He was a wonderful salesman.
Did he have a good rap?
Well, I mean, he didn't have a rap, because a rap is something you memorize. And my father was a very spontaneous man, and I never heard him repeat a story.
Did that
influence me?
Well, I was wondering if it helped inspire your interest in language.
It helped inspire my interest in story, because he always came back with wonderful tales of odd things that had happened to him on the road. And, I mean, he was an incredibly vivid man.
Did you read and write a lot when you were young?
I did more writing than reading. I mean, I never read a book until I was in high school. No, that's not true. I read See Here, Private Hargrove when I was 12 years old. And I read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn when I was, I think, 14. But that's it.
That's very unusual, isn't it, for someone to write a lot yet not read a lot?
Yes. I have no memory of being in high school, even. I mean, I remember nothing ever happened to me in terms of the intellectual until I went to college. And then suddenly the world lit up for me.
What changed?
They gave you assignments. That's what changed. Now, they gave you assignments in high school and in grammar school, too, I suppose. But one didn't really do them. One was out in the schoolyard.
So what were you writing about during those earlier years?
Oh, they were such dopey things. I remember that I wrote a story. I was perhaps 12 or 13 years old, and it was about some guy. I remember he was reading addresses, 7243, 7246, 7247, and finally he comes to the address that he's going, and he goes in and he kills somebody. I mean, it was just a dopey story.
Why did you want to write?
The answer is going to be so mysterious, and I mean, I've never been to a psychiatrist in my life, but my father had, we've already mentioned that he worked for Coro, and he had all of this stationery with the Coro Pegasus, which was the logo for the firm, and I enjoyed just writing on that letterhead with the Pegasus, and it seemed to me that I was making a kind of book. I mean, it's just, who knows? I can't explain that.
So there's almost something physical that you liked about writing?
It was something
visual.
It was a kind of production, just to see. I mean, if it had been on, I wouldn't have done it on plain paper.
Uh-huh. So you used to write all your stories on your father's stationery?
That's right. And then until I became ill, I used to write all my novels in university blue books, exam booklets.
And when you became ill, you started using a computer.
Right.
So, okay, you got to college, you started reading more. What did reading do for you? What did you find in books?
Style, language, the sense that, you know, one could say things that were, you know, just, if you've made a metaphor in a kind of way, you've found a thing. You've put something in the world that was never there before. It's as though you discovered grapes.
So when you started reading, did you find ideas that you thought but never expressed before, or people like you, or something that you deeply identified with?
No.
It was just about style.
Right. And in a kind of way, that's unfortunate, because to a certain extent, the rap on me is that, I'm all style and not a whole hell of a lot of plot. I don't think that's true as much as it used to be. I think that I discovered the idea of plot in combination with style with a novel I wrote, and it was published in 1982, called George Mills. And I think I've been able to do it ever since.
Some of my favorite writing of yours is essays in which you write about yourself and what you're thinking or what you're feeling. You had a recent essay about a period of temporary madness that you went through that was actually drug-induced by a drug that you were taking for the MS. Did you know when...
Well, I named the drug. It was prednisone.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very dangerous thing.
Did you know when you were going through this period of temporary madness that there was something wrong, or did you accept that reality as being reality?
Absolutely not. I thought, you know, I didn't know I was nuts until I was sitting in the shower and didn't know what I was supposed to be doing there. I had forgotten how to use soap. I had forgotten what water was for. And my wife Joan had to, put me through the paces of my shower. And I asked, how long has this been going on? She said, it's been going on for 2 or 3 weeks. And it was astonishing to me, because I thought that for 2 or 3 weeks, I'd been doing what I always did. I was working. And she said that, no, I hadn't been working. I'd been sitting on the side of the bed watching television. Not even watching television, but just using the remote control and snapping from one station to the next. And this was directly attributable to the fact that I was on this, I was ODing on prednisone.
You were prescribed too large an amount?
I was prescribed the right amount, but I, you know, you're supposed to taper off when you're taking prednisone, and the physical benefits of the drug are so astonishingly successful that I would not taper off, and I just kept feeding this stuff to myself.
Can you just describe a little bit what it was like, if you remember, to not know what water was for, to not know what soap was for?
It was, in a way, the most interesting. I mean, when I learned that I was nuts, it was the most, I obsessed on it. It was the most interesting thing that had ever happened to me. I mean, I can't even say that I was depressed. I was depressed when I was told that I had multiple sclerosis. I was not depressed when I was told that I was that I had to be hospitalized. And this only lasted, you know, for, well, I was in the hospital for 5 days, but the whole period of my madness was perhaps 2 months.
So what was fascinating about being that disoriented and not recognizing anything?
Well, I'm a person who, you know, concentrates on the world. And here I was concentrating on something that, you know, had nothing at all to do with the world. I mean, I was having hallucinations, and it was very strange, very strange.
Stanley Elkin, his new book is called Van Gogh's Room at Arles. He teaches at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Coming up, a profile of Mississippi John Hurt. This is Fresh Air. Rock historian Ed Ward says we tend to think of the blues singers from the Mississippi Delta as dark, driven men in the tradition of Robert Johnson. But Mississippi John Hurt was the exception, a gentle, happy person. Ed says that's why Hurt's music struck a chord with the folk revivalists in the early 60s, and why his recordings are still so well-loved.
I met Mississippi John Hurt during intermission at a show he gave at Oberlin College in 1965, and he must have liked me. "Don't tell nobody I did this," he said, pouring me a shot of whiskey from a bottle he produced from his jacket. "I know you're not of age, but I don't like to drink alone," he added, with the twinkle in his eye that endeared him to nearly everyone who saw him perform. "I've kept my word till now, but seeing as how I'm of age, and March 3rd was either the 100th or 101st anniversary of John Hurt's birth, I figure it's okay." In many ways, Mississippi John Hurt's story began very typically. He was born in Carroll County, Mississippi, and in 1928, a talent scout for OK Records heard him and sent him to Memphis to cut two sides.
Frankie was a good girl, everybody knew. She paid $100 for having one suit of clothes. He's a man, and he done her wrong.
Frankie was the old Frankie and Johnny, or in this case, Frankie and Albert story. And OK was caught off guard. They'd never expected a version of such a well-known story to sell as well as this did. But they probably also never reckoned with the power of that intricate chiming guitar line. In December of 1928, they brought him back twice, and he recorded 10 more songs, 9 of which were eventually issued, including Candyman Blues, his sly double entendre signature song.
All your ladies all gather round, that good sweet candy man's in town. It's the candy man, it's the candy man. He got the candy just 9 feet long. He sells as fast a hog and chew his cone. It's the candy man, it's the candy man.
these records never duplicated Frankie's success, and anyway, the Depression hit the record business hard, so records aimed at rural blacks weren't a high priority. But when the folk revival came along in the early 60s, Mississippi John Hurt's records were prized by guitar pickers. How did he do that, they all wondered. And whatever happened to him, others asked. Tom Hoskins, a Washington, D.C. folky, was listening to a tape of one of Hurt's rarest records one afternoon when he got a clue.
At New York this morning, just about half past nine. At New York this morning, just about half past nine. Thought of my Marin album, couldn't hardly keep from crying. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Put your mamas in Avalon, warm me there all the time.
Avalon's my hometown, always on my mind. Trouble was, there wasn't any Avalon on the map. But research showed there had been a hamlet by that name between Grenada and Greenwood in the late 19th century. So with his friend Mike Stewart, Hoskins headed to Mississippi in 1963. In Sunset, they stopped at a store with a number of old black men sitting on the porch and asked if anyone had ever heard of Mississippi John Hurt. Sure, one of the men said. About a mile down that road, third mailbox up the hill, can't miss it. They pulled into a farm, and a tractor came up, driven by a tiny old man who was as surprised as they were. They made some primitive recordings at Hurt's farm and discovered that his repertoire included hymns and lots of pre-blues rags and songs, like Richland Woman Blues.
Gave me red lipstick and a bright poppy root, a shingle bob haircut and a shot of good booze. Hurry down, sweet daddy, come blowin' your horn. If you come too late, sweet mama will be gone.
He might have been 71 or 72 years old, but he could still play. Once he got used to performing for the new audiences, he became an immense hit, and his storytelling and Yoda-like appearance warmed thousands over the next couple of years as he toured, playing the music he thought nobody would ever hear again.
My Creole Belle, I love her well. My darling baby, my Creole Belle. My Creole Belle, I love her well. My darling baby, my Creole Belle. When the stars shine.
Lots of us tried to play his simpler pieces like My Creole Belle, and some of the luckier ones got tips directly from the master himself. John Hurt died on November 2, 1966, and left behind a legacy of recordings played exquisitely by a virtuoso, capturing a music that existed before the blues became the dominant African-American musical form. Thanks, John, and happy birthday, however old you are.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You saw the dough. Hey, 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 you saw the dog. Says big fish, little fish swimming in the water. Come back here, man. Give me my quarter.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For many Chinese immigrants, America meant work. China meant home. Fei Mayan Ng dedicated her new novel to her great-grandfather, who labored in the farmland of California, separated from his family, which stayed behind in China. Coming up, we talk with Ng about being the first person in her family born in the United States. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Culture and Imperialism, Edward Said's new book about how imperialism left its mark on literature. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In El Salvador, a new political battle is forming in the wake of a UN report naming those responsible for some of the worst human rights violations during the nation's civil war. While the president of El Salvador has called for an immediate amnesty, former guerrillas of one group say they will oppose it. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports.
President Cristiani declined to comment on the findings of the UN Truth Commission or to commit himself to complying with its recommendations. Its report called for the dismissal of 40 senior army officers and for the urgent overhaul of the Salvadoran justice system. Instead, Cristiani focused on the need for forgiveness for war crimes and the prompt enactment of a general amnesty. It was a waste of time, he said, to dwell on recriminations. The FMLN, by contrast, said it fully accepted the report's recommendations, including a 10-year ban from political office for several of its leaders. The former guerrilla movement, now a political party, said it would press the Salvadoran legislature to oppose an amnesty until the government had complied with UN proposals. It would press in particular for a prompt overhaul of the judicial system and for a new inquiry into the involvement of wealthy and prominent Salvadorans in right-wing death squads. In San Salvador, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
President Clinton says that there are a lot of reasons to be hopeful that stalled Middle Eastern peace talks will get underway again. Meeting today at the White House with Israeli Prime Minister Rabin, Mr. Clinton said that the prime minister said that he is prepared to take risk in order to achieve peace. The Israeli leader said that his country is ready for compromises, but they cannot be one-sided, and he appealed to Palestinian diplomats to return to the Middle Eastern peace talks. In New York City, more than 2 weeks after a bomb exploded underneath the World Trade Center, search teams have found another victim, bringing the death toll to six. Mandalit Del Barco of member station WNYC reports.
The victim was identified as Wilfredo Mercado, the only person who had still been missing from the World Trade Center explosion. Using specially trained dogs, searchers found his body intact under hundreds of tons of rubble and twisted steel. Mercado was a 37-year-old receiving manager for the Vista Hotel, last seen unloading supplies in the B2 level of the parking garage where the bomb was centered. That bomb blew a crater in the garage, killing five others, injuring thousands, and forcing the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from the Twin Towers complex. There are still thousands of tons of rubble sitting at the bottom of the huge crater. Authorities say they've notified Mercado's wife, who for 2 weeks had hoped they'd find her husband alive. For National Public Radio, I'm Mandalit Del Barco in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 14 points to close at 3,442.41 in very active trading. This is NPR News. Officials say at least 128 people died in a blizzard that hit the eastern part of the nation this weekend. While people are still digging out of deep snow, travel has continued to be snarled with icy streets and runways. Hundreds of thousands of people have no power in their homes. And in North Carolina, more than 160,000 people are estimated to be snowbound at home or in shelters. Friday, the storm hit Florida with tornadoes and then pushed up the coast with hurricane-force winds, dropping as much as 4 feet of snow and drifts of up to 15 feet. In Bombay, India, police have defused two powerful bombs and made their first arrest since more than 250 people died in a series of explosions last week. John Reddy in Bombay has more on the story.
It was a good day for the police after mounting complaints that they'd done little to catch the bombers. They tracked down two men believed to have planted bombs in five-star hotels last Friday and who are wanted on murder charges. But police met a hail of fire when they tried to arrest the two suspects, who escaped in the ensuing shootout. The two bombs found today were on motor scooters and were big enough to have totally destroyed the nearby gold and diamond market. The dealer and his mechanic, who couldn't explain who they'd sold the scooters to, were arrested. Meanwhile, stores and offices went back to business on the first working day since the bombs. The badly damaged stock exchange reopened for an hour's trading and enjoyed a rise in the index after a demonstrative buying spree. For National Public Radio, I'm John Retty in Bombay.
Officials at the U.S. Transportation Department have announced approval for 1 year on a bid by British Airways to buy a stake of 19.9% in U.S. Air. In 12 months' time, the foreign investment will be looked at again. This agreement would pave the way for British Air to become a code-sharing partner on U.S. Air on flights linking U.S. Air cities. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Faye Mayan Ng was the first person in her family born in the United States. She grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown. Her first novel, Bone, is about three sisters, each first-generation Chinese-American. One leaves Chinatown for New York. One jumps out the window of her Chinatown Housing Project apartment. The third, the narrator of the story, has moved crosstown to live with her boyfriend, who she secretly marries. In the New York Times Sunday Book Review, Lewis B. Jones wrote, "Bone is written in a perfectly clear, undecorated prose that stops the eye at every sentence." Ms. Ng makes it clear that moving across town to a new neighborhood can be, in its own way, as hard as crossing the Pacific Ocean. Faye Mayan Ng now lives in Brooklyn, New York. Here's a reading from the opening of her book.
"We were a family of three girls. By Chinese standards, that wasn't lucky. In Chinatown, everyone knew our story. Outsiders jerked their chins, looked at us, shook their heads. We heard things. A failed family, that Dulcie Fu, and you know which one, bald Leon. Nothing but daughters. Leon told us not to care about what people said. People talking, people jealous. He waved a hand in the air. Five sons don't make one good daughter. I'm Layla, the oldest, Ma's first, from before Leon. Ona came next, and then Nina. First, middle, and end girl. Our order of birth marked us and came to tell more than our given names. Here's another bone for the gossip mongers. On vacation recently, visiting Nina in New York, I got married. I didn't marry on a whim, so don't worry, I didn't do a green card number. Mason Louis was no stranger. We'd been together 4-5 years, and it was time. Leon was the first person I wanted to tell, so I went looking for him in Chinatown. He's not my real father, but he's the one who's been there for me. Like he always told me, it's time that makes a family, not just blood. Ma and Leon are still married, but after Ona jumped off the Nam, Leon moved out. It was a bad time. Too much happened on Salmon Alley. We don't talk about it. Even the sewing ladies leave it alone."
Thank you for reading that, Fei Mianning. You dedicate your new novel, Bone, to your great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you dedicate it to him?
My great-grandfather was our first ancestor in this country, and I was very close to him. I was very moved by his life. He came here and mined the abandoned gold mines in this country. He worked for, I think, close to 70 years as a coolie in the farmlands of California, and he had a very hard life. He never was able to live with his wife or to see his children. And I was very moved by this kind of living. There were many men of his generation that I was close to as a child, and I was very moved by their loneliness and also by their ability to give despite the hardship and the suffering. And I wanted to remember this generation. My great-grandfather's bones remain here in this country with us. And I was always very grateful for that. We asked him before he passed on if he wanted his bones sent back to China, and this was the tradition during his generation. And he said to us, no, it's not necessary. And I felt that that was a great gift because it gave us the possibility of having a solid footing in this country in many ways. And I use his name, Ah Sam, because this was a name that I only discovered long after he died.
Was that his real name?
No. He had a beautiful. He had a true name, a Chinese name, with. But this was the name that was given to him as he passed through the immigration center on Angel Island, and this is the name he lived with, and this is the name that his employers called him by. And he answered to it, and I wanted to remember that.
Your great-grandfather didn't get to see his wife and children very much. Was that because they stayed behind in China?
It was the tradition then. The feeling was that America was work and China was home. So men of his generation often came here and worked and then went home when they had enough money and fathered children and then came back here and worked, continued working. It wasn't encouraged the laws didn't encourage Chinese immigration and women were not allowed in. So his wife stayed in China. I think he only saw her two or three times at the most. And I was always I always wondered what life was like for a man who didn't have the possibility of having the warmness of a family, of a relationship. I always felt there was a kind of hollowness in that kind of life. And I think in some ways that's our heritage in this country. There's a kind of disharmony between the men and the women, and I wanted to look at that.
In your novel, the main character's stepfather separates from the mother, and he lives in one of these bachelor hotel flea bags.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to visit him there a lot and becomes familiar with this male culture through her visits to him. How close did you get to that male culture when you were growing up?
Oh, very close. There was a whole generation of what we call the bachelors, the old bachelors, the Chinese Bachelor Society. I remember a childhood filled with old men, and they stood around Chinatown. I always had this image of them as I don't know how to describe them. They were just a very large presence and a very peaceful presence. I thought of them as pillars in some way. They were very loving and gentle. And I felt that this came, what impressed me was this came despite their life of suffering. They were very lonely. They had very little money, and often when they died, they had no family. So the younger generation always had the job of preparing their burial. And it taught me something about community, about how you make a family in a new land or in any new situation, that we choose our family.
My guest is Fei Mayan Ng, author of the new novel Bone. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Fei Mayan Ng. How did your mother and father come to the United States?
Well, my mother didn't come till 53, so she was part of the whole communist movement, and it was a very hard decision for her to leave, but she had married my father. My father was here in the 40s, and she came. Her decision was that she chose family over country, and I think that was very interesting for her.
And your father came here to work?
My father came at a very young age. He came in his teens. Yes, and he came here to work.
Were you their first child born in the United States?
Yes, I was.
Does that put a special burden or responsibility on you, or a special privilege?
I think both. There was a great I felt a great responsibility to show them the outside world. I also felt a tremendous burden to try to make their lives better, which is very ironic because they essentially, as immigrants, I feel they are a sacrifice generation. Their lives were spent completely in labor in the hopes that their children would have better. But yet, as a child, I felt very, very deeply that I wanted to make their lives better.
It was the tradition for Chinese immigrants to send their bones back to China for, mm-hmm. for burial. Did anyone in your family do that? You said your great-grandfather let his bones be buried here, and that, in a way, gave the rest of the family permission to feel that America was more of their home. Mm-hmm. Was there anyone else who had their bones sent back?
Not in my family, but I was aware of the ritual when I was a child. I went to a lot of funerals when I was a child, and I understood the importance of this ritual very, very early on. That true happiness came, I can't even say it was true happiness. I just never felt that these men would rest until they were in China.
What were the funerals like when you were young?
What were the funerals like? They were very makeshift. They were often very poor, and so we had to pull our resources together to get them the right burial clothes. And I write about this in the book, or I try to appreciate this gesture in the book. There was also a kind of comfort about the funerals because there was a kind of dialogue with the dead that we learned about very early in life, that somehow the journey after death is a very true journey. So we came to funerals full of emotion and full of the possibility of talking to the dead. And then even after their death, we visited their graves and we conversed with them, and they lived with us in many ways. So it wasn't frightening in the way that sometimes I have felt the funerals I've gone to after childhood are.
The stepfather in your novel is quote, a paper son,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that he kind of made up a past
mm-hmm.
in order to pass the interrogation at Angel Island when he came to the United States. So he memorized another man's history
yes.
to pass the interrogation. Why was that necessary?
Oh, it was a common way to circumvent the exclusion laws. You know, the immigrants who came to this country and had true papers often went back to China and then upon re-entry said, oh, I had three sons, and then they'd sell these slots to men who were interested in coming to America. So you would actually memorize another man's history. And I was very interested in this kind. This was fascinating to me to suddenly be able to absorb another history. You know, there was this duality that existed. There was your paper name and your paper history, and there was your real name. And there was a lot of work involved in keeping the lives separate. And I, you know, in this book, I wanted to create that kind of fractured family. I created a stepfather and a stepdaughter and half-sisters to speak about that condition in Chinese American history, that we don't have the luxury of having a very clear bloodline or family, a sense of, you know, easy connection. And I wanted in the Leong family to show what that was like. Leon says it's not just blood, it's also time. And I wanted to look at how we choose our family in this country.
Now, I know that you, like your main character, grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown. When your main character leaves, she feels kind of guilty about it
mm-hmm.
for several reasons. You live in New York City now. You live in Brooklyn, New
yes.
York. Did you feel guilty about moving out of Chinatown?
Well, you know, I felt guilty about having an education. I felt guilty about having a better chance at having time in my life. I felt that my parents and their whole generation, they essentially were the sacrifice generation. They had no possibility of those small moments of joy that I had. And so, I wanted to give Lei this quality. I wanted her to feel great compassion and great guilt for her mother's inability to live as fully as she should. And for Lei, I gave her this great challenge of marrying for love, something her mother was not able to do. Ma marries for convenience and for thrill and has a dangerous love affair. And I felt that the greatest challenge Lei could have was to finally do this one thing, which was to marry for true love, which is, I think, what Ma wanted to do.
So you felt guilty about having opportunities. You felt guilty about education, felt guilty about pleasure. But that's what they wanted you to have.
Yes, and I think that was a very difficult thing that is a difficult condition in I think a lot of first generation children. We witness how hard the immigrant generation worked, how much they sacrificed to give us this opportunity, and it's very hard to just take it. But it's our responsibility, and it's our great moment of courage to be able to take the opportunity. And there's a phrase in Chinese, to finally give back to your parents, to finally, through your own success, give back the joy and the pride. But I think it's a very it's very difficult. It's very difficult to have better than your parents, to marry better, to see better. I think it's our duty to continue forward, but I think there's a lot of difficulty.
Fei Mayan Ng is the author of the new novel, Bone. By the way, she spells her last name N-G. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel at All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, news of the report of the Truth Commission on El Salvador, looking into who was responsible for war crimes during that country's civil war. Also, reaction in Salvador to release of the report at the United Nations. A report on Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's visit to Washington and his meeting with President Bill Clinton today. People still digging out from under the storm of the great blizzard of 93. News about that today. A new book, A Zoo Goer's Companion, A Guide to Animal Behaviors. We'll be hearing about that. And also about a man from Norway whose name is Davidson, Harley Davidson. Those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Edward Said has spent much of his career trying to dismantle myths and misconceptions about the Arab world for the rest of the world. Said was born in Palestine. His family left for Cairo in 1947. He attended college in this country and is now a professor of English at Columbia University. Said's new book, Culture and Imperialism, continues to develop the ideas he put forth 15 years ago in his book, Orientalism. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
When Edward Said issued his magisterial Orientalism back in 1978, it should have changed the way we think. Orientalism, he told us, is a text compiled by scholars, a trope embellished by novelists, a distribution of geopolitical awareness in our libraries and our heads to bolster the self-esteem of the West. We need and therefore hallucinate an Orient that's changeless, passive, and dependent, a brutish other to which we can feel superior, and so excuse ourselves for a little imperialism here, a lot more racism there, and a fantasy life that's distinctly kinky. By the hand, Said led us through the culture-bound presumptions of historians, the metaphorical excesses of poets, the ethnographic arrogance of philologists, our ignorance of Islam, and our many clichés about lazy natives, dangerous sex, cruel Turks, and bad hygiene. But of course, during the Gulf War, there was everybody on television talking all over again about the Arab mind. So Said's gone back to his drawing board. In Culture and Imperialism, he examines the way the West gobbled up not only what Joseph Conrad called the blank spaces on the map, but also the blank spaces in our heads, our structures of attitude and reference, the very geography of thought. For example, Jane Austen never bothered her pretty head about the fact that Mansfield Park depended on slave labor on West Indian sugar plantations. In Albert Camus' novels, Arabs don't have names or histories. Verdi and Aida staged ancient Egypt as a culture of death. Matthew Arnold endorsed martial law and the massacre of Jamaican blacks in 1865. De Tocqueville deplored American treatment of blacks, but not French treatment of Muslim Arabs. Malraux went to Indochina, only to steal Cambodian art. The script these Westerners wrote, says Said, was a cultural discourse, regulating and confining the non-European to a secondary racial, cultural, ontological status. A status maintained not only by force of arms, but by such persuasive means as colonial cities like Delhi, Algiers, and Saigon, in new media like travel photography, new artistic styles like monumental sculpture, and new sciences like anthropology and linguistics. And that's just half of this contentious book. The other half insists that we read our other, a third world literature of resistance, of Caliban talking back to Prospero, of writers as various as Garcia Marquez, Salman Rushdie, Chinua Achebe, and Derek Walcott. Said is furious at academic disciplines like deconstruction, discourse analysis, the old Marxism, and the new historicism, which omit imperialism as a critical category. And he is sick at heart about nativism, nationalism, and sectarian violence in the post-colonial world. Not at all what he'd hoped for from the very narratives of emancipation and enlightenment he asks us to consult. I have quarrels. He leaves out many writers, even a few empires. His American section is superficial. The Far East is ignored entirely. But since Rushdie is one of his favorite writers, think of Orientalism as Said's version of Midnight's Children, a kind of origin myth, which makes culture and imperialism his satanic verses, an epic of migration and metamorphosis, a kind of post-colonial Iliad for all of the boat people in a torn and rootless world.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Culture and Imperialism by Edward Said. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Robert Alls. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the acclaimed cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He won Oscars for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory. He's also directed and shot a number of documentaries. Next month, the American Museum of the Moving Image presents a retrospective of Wexler's work. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.